Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Editorial Review. The Law Editorial is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Editorial is an educational service in public interest, and your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on What If, when we come back. Well, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, King Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1 verse 7 that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year the continents and islands of the world pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. It's been calculated to be about 286,000 cubic miles of water. And now for century after century, millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea hasn't increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is all of that possible? Well, we call it the circle or cycle of evaporation and precipitation. The writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came. And indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds and ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. Now, in the modern science of meteorology, we all understand this, and we comprehend the laws. Modern science, then, today, has now learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in Scripture. And it's one of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I conduct here twice a year at the law school in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, and just click onto the email machine, and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Before we get started on What If tonight, I got a letter the other day, and I thought I would answer it because it's a part of a series that we did here, I don't know, a month ago or something like that. It was a series that I did on the Passover. And he wrote me a question. And he said, I have a question that I hope you can answer. And he said, after listening to the Passover series in the archives, I am wondering about the time frame of the Passover relative to the phases of the moon. If the 14th day of Abib is determined by the phase of the moon, for example, if the month begins at the full moon, and the Pharisees started their month at the first sliver of the new moon, and they called that the first sliver of the new moon, and the scripture states that the Messiah was killed according to their, that is the Jews, cited in John 11:55 Passover, was Jesus the Messiah, Emmanuel, Joshua, was he sacrificed on the correct Passover? Now, if I have this right, there's a significant difference in the timeline, and I've been previously taught that the true Passover was one day earlier than Passover designated by the time frame established by the first sliver theory. Needless to say, I'm confused. So thanks for any consideration that you could show me regarding this matter. Signed, Richard. Well, Richard, you're not the first guy who's been confused concerning Passover or holy days or Sabbaths. In fact, if you think about it for a second, think about it. There are 400, last time I heard, 476 incorporated religious doctrines, incorporated religious churches, sects, schisms, groups, organizations, you name it. And that's what the government has incorporated. In addition to that, there's a bunch more out there that the government doesn't even know about. And they all call themselves Christian. And they're all doing things that they claim comes out of the Bible. And they all claim to be religious and they all go to church. But here's the key, Richard. They don't all agree. And so, of course, a question comes up, well, which one of them's right? Well, think about that for a second, because 476 different ideas concerning the Passover. There may not be 476 different ones. It could be that out of 476 of these religious organizations, perhaps they only have 30 conflicting ideas concerning the Passover, or 10 or 15 or 20. But, you know, whether it's 476 or 2, they can't all be right. Now, can they? Because if any one of those ideas is correct, then all of the rest of those ideas are incorrect, aren't they? Now, there's a second facet. If you've got 476 people and they all disagree on a particular topic, all 476 of them could be wrong because there could be a 477th correct answer. But whatever the correct answer is, if it deviates from the other 476 or 322 or 30 or 2, one of them's correct and the rest of them are incorrect. Now, let's understand, I don't claim to be correct. I didn't come to you and say, gee, believe me, because I've got the truth and everybody else is wrong. That's theology. I'm a reporter, partner. I collect facts and I disseminate facts. How you use those facts, Dick, is your business and life, not mine. But you asked, so let me tell you the answer. I happen to know what it is. But you've got a horns of a dilemma here, because if, in fact, the Jews were keeping the Passover on the sliver moon and then sacrificed the Messiah on the sliver moon, well, then they were 2 weeks earlier than the correct Passover designated by Moses back in Exodus chapter 12. Jesus never had any complaints about Passover Day. In fact, if you take a look in Matthew 26, he's telling his disciples to go off and go to this guy in town, and he's going to take you up to an upper room and there prepare the Passover. And then as you follow the story flow through, you find out that Jesus becomes the Passover, and he is sacrificed on the Passover Day. He's hung on the stake at about noon. He dies at 3 o'clock. He's off the stake by 4, and they've got him buried. He evidently thought that the Jews had it on the right day, at least the day he died. He didn't have any complaint about the Jews and the day they were keeping the Passover. And the assumption that everybody follows is that if the Jews were doing it correctly when they killed the Messiah, and they're still doing it to this day, well, then obviously the sliver moon must be the correct time frame. I mean, that's conventional wisdom, makes all the sense in the world. All right, now let's go back to Moses. In Psalm 81, verse 3, it doesn't say it in the King James, but if you trace it out, it says that the new moon is the full moon. That's Psalm 81, verse 3. Look it up in the concordance, and you'll see that word that's used there for the new moon is the full moon. Now, if that's the case, then back in Moses' day, if the full moon was the correct time, and if the Jews were celebrating the Passover on the first sliver of the moon, and if they're doing that to this day, then that's a real contradiction in the Scripture, and the Scripture says that the Scriptures have no private interpretation. God says he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He says, I change not, and the Scripture cannot be broken. Now, how do you reconcile all of that? Well, that's a real horns of a dilemma, isn't it? Okay. The answer is, the Jews, at the time that they killed the Messiah, were keeping the Passover on the full moon. And they had been keeping the Passover on the full moon, by and large, not continuously, but by and large, from the time of Moses. And in Jerusalem, they were still keeping it at the time of the full moon, and they kept it at the time of the full moon long after that, until about 358 A.D., when one of their grand poobahs, a guy by the name of Haliel, I believe that's the way you pronounce his name, Haliel, with the insistence of the Romans, you got to remember the Romans were still in power until 476 A.D., when the Roman Empire dissolved. But they were still in operation, and the Romans, very religious people, they were Mithraic religious people, and Christianity was coming on the scene, and they had a problem, and they had a Sabbath problem. It was called the Quarto Dicemini Controversy. Quarto Dicemini Controversy. And so one of the Roman emperors, a guy by the name of Constantine, came along and he said, you know, we're not going to have any more of this Judaizing. We don't like it. And so we're going to have some stringent penalties, and we're going to change the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. So if you want to know who changed the Sabbath, it was the Roman Catholic Church, and they don't hide it. Go look it up in the Catholic Encyclopedia. They'll tell you plainly. We changed it, and everybody follows us. Everybody in the world is a Catholic. Well, all the Christians are Catholics, except for the Seventh-day Adventists and a few oddballs out here that keep the Sabbath. They're not Catholic. Everybody else is. And Revelation 17 tells you that story, Richard. They tell you very plainly that you got this mother whore, and then you've got these daughters. That's the Catholic Church and these Protestant daughters. All of them practice Easter. They're not even in the game. They're not on the first step of the ladder. Now, there are a few people that practice the Passover, of which the Jews today are one of those groups. They actually don't practice it, but they do observe it. If you were going to practice something, you would actually do what you were instructed to do in Exodus chapter 12. Nobody does that. And that's because we're all smarter than God, and so we figured out that he made a bunch of mistakes there in Exodus 12, so we fixed all those mistakes, including the time that we're going to keep it, whether it's based upon the new moon, being the silver, full moon, or the crescent moon. So when the Romans came to the Jews in 358 A.D., I believe that's the year, now I looked at that just what's in between my ears over here, they came to the Jews and they said, okay, boys, we think that you should change your calendar. And Haliel came along and said, you know, we think that's real good of you, and we think we'll do that. Because the Romans, you know, they said, well, if you don't, we'll kill you. And the Jews said, we see the wisdom of your argument, and they changed the calendar. So at the time the Messiah was killed, they were practicing it by the full moon. The Messiah didn't have any complaints. 350 years later, they changed it, and today the Jews follow the Babylonian mystery religion. They follow the Babylonian system, and they keep it by the crescent. And by the way, all the Muslims observe moon worship also. It's a part of moon worship. And our ancestors, you know, all those Vikings that wore those horns on their head, that's the crescent moon. They also practiced in that heathen practice. So Israelites have always followed the pagan nations around them. Once in a while, we have obeyed God and kept his commandments. Not any more often than we had to, but once in a while we got roped into it and we actually did what we were told. So the answer to your question is, in 358 AD, I think I've got that correct. And if it isn't, it was 300 plus years after the Messiah was killed that the Jewish calendar was changed. And they practice now the Babylonian mystery religion calendar of the Christians. So they follow the Christians, just like everybody else that claims to be Christian follows Christianity. So there's that story. Now, we were talking about this thing of what if. What if? Let me read you this story from the Rocky Mountain News, a newspaper out in Denver, Colorado. And it's a story about a lady by the name of Bernice Bogart, age 83, is shown here in a picture from a Spiker report, source Rocky Mountain News, 4106. You know, we're talking about yesterday as I speak. I'm speaking to you here today on 4-2. This is yesterday's news report. It says, Sally Moon had to cool off for the better part of this week before she could see straight enough to write a complaint about a security agent's treatment of her elderly mother at the Denver International Airport. At first, she couldn't settle on the right words to use. Horrific, mind-boggling, and outrageous were a few that came to mind. Anyone could see that Bernice Bogart, age 83, was a fragile and frail woman, Moon said. Bogart had breast cancer surgery in 1997, a total hip replacement after a fall in 1999, a major stroke in 2004 that caused dementia, and is hard of hearing. So when Bogart, who was in a wheelchair, was required by airport security on Saturday to stand against the doctor's orders and then undergo a rigorous screening by a testy female screener, Moon, her daughter, got furious. I don't know if she thought my mother had a bomb in her depends or what, Moon said. A Transportation Security Administration spokeswoman said Thursday that a high level of professionalism and courtesy is expected from its screeners, and Moon's complaint is being looked into. But Moon doubts anyone will be held accountable. This week, she sat at her computer in Colorado Springs and emailed the TSA's Office of Civil Rights. So the Transportation Safety Administration has an Office of Civil Rights, evidently. It goes on and says, although I imagine this complaint will go straight to the trash, and the agent responsible will face no consequences and receive no reprimand, I couldn't sleep until I at least voiced my outrage, she began. Moon said that at about 6 p.m. on Saturday, she and her sister were walking alongside their mother, who was in a wheelchair being pushed by a Frontier Airlines employee to a special screening area at the head of DIA's Concourse A. Just before reaching security, Moon's sister, who did not have gate clearance, was asked to sit in a chair away from the screening area while Moon and her mother proceeded. Bogart was holding an orthopedic card saying that she had a metal plate in her hip. Having been assured that Frontier and the TSA staff would not require Bogart to leave her wheelchair, Moon turned her back to put her mother's bags through the x-ray screener. Moon said she was horrified when she turned around moments later to discover that her mother had been selected for additional screening and was out of her wheelchair and hobbling through a large glass-walled corridor. There were no grab bars, Moon said. What I could see really was her fingers trying to hang on to a little ledge. Fearing that her mother would have another hip-shattering fall, Moon instinctively reached out for her mother. Don't touch her, Moon, says the screener, barked at her. As the elderly woman shuffled along, Moon said she continued to tell the screener that her mother was not to stand without her four-wheeled walker. You'd better change your attitude, Moon recalls the screener screaming, or do you want me to make you, or to put you on the don't fly today list? So the screener allowed Bogart to sit down for a moment and then instructed her to stand up and lift her arms, Moon reported. Well, Bogart, the mother, could barely raise her arms due to the breast cancer surgery, so the screener lifted them higher herself, Moon said. Infuriated, Moon protested and said she was told to sit across the room or else. I know that they prolonged their search of my mother because she was mad at me, Moon said. Bogart had been nervous about flying alone for the first time since her husband's death last year. She sat back down in the wheelchair after the screening in shocked silence, her daughter said. 2 hours later, Bogart was in the air en route to Nashville, Tennessee, to visit her youngest daughter for a month. Moon marched back to security to give management a piece of her mind. She demanded the name of the young screener in her mid to late 20s with dark hair pulled back in a bun. The TSA manager refused to give her the screener's name. And Moon said she suggested that she file a general complaint. Several days later, Moon did just that. If you've read this far, I'm surprised, she wrote in closing, but if you have, you can now toss this letter, send me one of those form letters indicating that you take these kinds of complaints very seriously and are going to investigate the matter, blah, 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 and then get back to more important activities, unquote. Well, Moon can expect a response from the TSA's Office of Civil Rights, Denver TSA spokeswoman Carrie Harmon said. When we receive complaints, we take them very seriously, Harmon said. We investigate them, and we address any personnel issues as appropriate, Harmon said. Reached at her youngest daughter's home in Nashville on Thursday, Bogart said she didn't want to get anybody in trouble, and she emphasized that they were all very kind except for that one girl. I thought she was a little harsh. I thought it was a little too much, she added, and she wouldn't let my daughter help me, and I have a hard time standing very long. DIA spokesman Chuck Cannon expressed surprise at Bogart's tale, but said ultimately the airport has no authority to regulate the TSA, which is a federal agency. I honestly don't know why they would have made a woman in that condition get up and walk through secondary screening, he said. I'm sure it's all just a misunderstanding, but we hate for these things to happen, and we wish they wouldn't happen. Cited from the Rocky Mountain News. What do you think of that story? Well, let me tell you, I subscribe here to a number of newsletters, and we probably process 10 news reports a day, probably 30 days a month. So let's see how many that is, 10 times, about 300 a month, 300. And I can tell you from firsthand experience that these kinds of reports come across my desk every day. I see one or two of these every day. Now, if there's one a day, and there's 365 days in a year, that means that there's 365 of these somewhere in America every year, which isn't very many. Isn't very many. But I would like to point out that I have not seen a single report like this complaining about the greeter in a Walmart store. Now, the airlines, as far as I can tell, are businesses that are trying to get people like George Gordon and Bogart, B-O-G-A-R-T, to fly on their airlines in the same way that Walmart would like Mrs. Bogart to come into the Walmart store and do her shopping. What I noticed in Walmart was Walmart not only doesn't screen old ladies like this or put them through secondary screening or yell and scream at these old ladies' daughters, they even furnish powered wheelchairs at no extra cost whatsoever. Now, that's the difference between Walmart and Delta or Frontier or United Airlines. And I want you to notice that in the last paragraph here, the guy speaking for the airline says, a second to the last paragraph, he says, DIA spokesman Chuck Cannon expressed surprise at Bogart's tale. He said, ultimately, the airport has no authority to regulate the TSA. That's a federal agency. Okay, let's try this. Let's bring a federal agency into Walmart, and let's have the federal agent at Walmart take over as the new greeter. You walk into Walmart, and they say, bend over and pull down your pants. We want to look up the crack of your ass so that we can see if you've got explosives hidden up there. That's a common body search technique that's done in our airports today. Did you know that? Hell, I'm used to that being an old jailbird. They do that in jails to see if you've got contraband. I haven't had that happen to me at Walmart, but I want to tell you that the first time that I walk into Walmart and they tell me to bend over and spread your cheeks will be the last time I go to Walmart. And I've already had my last time in flying on American Airlines. And I don't mean the company American Airlines. I mean any U.S. airline. Yes, it's kind of like revenge because I can remember when I operated a little company called the Barrister's Inn, you know, some years back. I used to travel all over the United States. I've been in every state in the Union many times. And I've conducted many seminars and many schools and many talks and traveled extensively. We spend, on average, $30,000 a year on airfare. And then I had a couple of complaints and I had a couple of problems with the airlines over the years. But nothing like we're seeing today in the airline in these airport terminals. This is so common that it's like oranges in Walmart. I mean, if I went into Walmart and there weren't any oranges in there, I'd think there was something wrong. If you went into an airport somewhere in America and you didn't have one of these events transpire once a day in America, something's wrong. So this lady Moon and Bogart, see, this is the first time that their ox got gored, and it just really ticked them off. So until your ox gets gored, you know, you tend to go along with it. You know, you go along to get along, or you get along to go along, or something like that. I was talking to a former congresswoman not too long ago. She's in Boise, Idaho. Her name is Helen Chenoweth. And they did that to her in the airport, and she hasn't flown on an airliner since, and that was about a year ago. And this woman is on the, you know, she's on the lecture circuit. She travels all over America, and she gives lectures and talks, and I'll bet you that woman was spending $20,000, $30,000 a year on the airlines. Not anymore. So I just wanted you people at the airlines to know that between George Gordon and Helen Chenoweth, you've lost $60,000 a year worth of business, and we won't come back to your airlines. In fact, in this week's International Forecaster, Bob Chapman, was talking to one of his buddies who is a Frenchman, I think it's the story, who travels all over the world, and he avoids coming to the United States of America. So if he has to fly, you know, let's say from Paris to Caracas, Venezuela, and normally the airplane comes to New York and then goes from New York to Caracas, he doesn't take that flight. He won't take that flight because it comes to the United States and subjects him and his wife and his children to this kind of indignity. So indignity and insanity. I'm just going to put the word insanity on there because only government could do such a thing to business. Now, I don't think that this is being done accidentally. I think it's being done intentionally for the express purpose of destroying the American economy. And it won't take very long because one of these days, one of these Arabs is going to walk into a busy Walmart store and blow himself up at the checkout counter. And he should be able to kill 30 or 40 or 50 people. I mean, if you're anything like our Walmart stores here, you know, Now, as soon as they do that, then there's going to be this threat, isn't there? And so now the government will have to come into all the Walmart stores and Circle K stores and et cetera, and they'll have to screen everybody before they come in. I mean, you talk about an Orwellian nightmare. Just get ready, boys and girls, because I don't think the airports is the end of the problem. So this brings us back to what if. What if instead of treating people like they're wild animals that have to be controlled, you know, in a cage, what if the airlines treated people like Walmart does? You know, boys and girls, I don't think that American Airlines would have nearly the economic problems that they're having today if they were to run those businesses like Walmart runs its business. But I don't think it's going to be very long until Walmart is going to be running their business like the government and the airlines are running theirs. And I think that Walmart's going to have a hard time selling people like me on the idea that we should go to their store to shop. Now, the airlines and the government, I believe, and I think that they believe that you don't have any alternatives, that, you know, the airlines have a captive audience, and if you want to travel, you have to fly. I can tell you, boys and girls, that's not true. That's not so. And I think that they'll do this one of these days in a supermarket because they believe that, you know, you have to eat, so you have to go to the supermarket. And boys and girls, that's not entirely true either. Now, it is true that many people are captives of the airline industry, but we're not all captives of the airline industry. And those of us that aren't captives won't fly. Furthermore, I won't even take a Greyhound bus. Now, I would take the train, but I don't think I could get on a train. And if they're going to treat me on Amtrak like they treat this lady on the airlines, I won't ride the train either. So if I have to walk, then I'll walk, but I won't ride the public transportation. As they say, where I'm from, they can go to hell in a handbasket. But don't think that this is unusual. It's very common. And if the people involved were to ask themselves, what if we changed our modality? Would people start flying more? Would Helen Chenoweth come back to the airlines? Certainly. You know, when you people in the airline industry wake up to reality and you change your Gestapo tactics, we'll probably come back and fly on your airplanes again. I'm not holding my breath until the airlines change their tactics. I'm watching and waiting for the government's tactics to be applied to Walmart and to every other business in America, because I really think that the hidden agenda is to destroy the American economy. I don't think it has anything to do with the health, safety, or welfare of the traveling public, or the buying public, for that matter. All right, so we've taken care of a couple of big-ticket items. Let's give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and we are open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review does not necessarily endorse 100% of those viewpoints. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, managers, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the law or an editorial review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Going back to the International Forecaster, which I guess I should give you a site. You can just go to internationalforecaster.com. That's easy enough, internationalforecaster.com. And you can take a look at the newsletter. I recommend it pretty highly. That, among others, it's not the only newsletter in the world, but Spiker is another good one. And there's a number of news sources that come over the Internet that we cite information from. And the reason I tell you that I can get one of these Mrs. What was her name here again? Bogart. Mrs. Bogart type stories from all kinds of people, young people, old people, people that are crippled in wheelchairs and people that aren't. That's the way they're treated in the airports. And so I'm pretty confident that that's true, accurate, and correct. As I say, you know, we just report news and facts, and that's one of the news and that's one of the facts. And I thought I'd tie that in with what if, because, you know, it's a part of our vocabulary. It's a part of our lexicon here in America. We always like to look at things in hindsight and say, well, gee, what if? What if? Well, let me tell you another story here from the International Forecaster. Listen to this. It's about 15 million more taxpayers with incomes ranging from $75,000 to $500,000 a year are expected to get hit with the alternative minimum tax. The AMT, alternative minimum tax. It was created 40 years ago. It's not something that Bush created or Bill Clinton. Don't blame it on that. Alternative minimum tax created 40 years ago to ensure that the richest people in America pay their fair share of income tax. The AMT, the alternative minimum tax, is expected to add $1,000 to tax bills for couples with incomes of around $100,000 a year. AMT has not been adjusted for inflation since 1969. And the 2001 income tax cuts do not affect the alternative minimum tax, which often makes it to the higher of the two taxes. The AMT also doesn't allow other tax breaks, such as mortgage and investment insurance and personal exemptions for children. Just a standard exemption of $58,000 for married couples filing jointly and $40,250 for most others. What is left is taxed at 26% for incomes below $175,000 and 28% for anything higher. Now, that's not the end of the world, because tax rates have been higher in the past. And they have come down, and we got to give George Bush credit. Remember, he's the one that engineered the tax cuts. I personally think that was one of the better moves that George Bush and the Republicans came up with. Unfortunately, the alternative minimum tax isn't affected by these tax cuts. And I'm fully persuaded that George Bush, when they were engineering these tax cuts, remember, and that was high-profile tax cuts, vote Republican, you get tax cuts. I'm fully persuaded that they knew full well that when they gave you all these tax cuts, that it wasn't going to affect the alternative minimum tax, which takes more than the income tax took before they gave you the tax cuts. In fact, the George Bush tax cuts were in fact a tax increase. And there was a lot of ballyhoo about, oh my God, this is tax cuts for the rich. Oh no, boys and girls. This was a tax increase on the middle class. Tax increase on the middle class. And here's the way the program works. George Bush comes along and he says, I want to increase taxes, but if I go out to the people and tell them, gee, I want to increase your taxes, they're not going to vote for me. So what I need to do is go out here and tell these people I'm going to give them a tax cut. But government doesn't want to cut taxes. They need more money, not less. We want bigger government, not smaller government. We've got to have more money. How are we going to do that? Here's what we'll do. We've got the alternative minimum tax. As soon as we give these people the income tax relief, it kicks them onto the AMT, which is higher than the income tax. So you people all said, yay, yay, we get tax cuts. And then the media jumped on it and they said, tax cuts for the rich, not tax cuts for the poor. Boys and girls, the poor don't pay taxes. Well, I guess I shouldn't say the poor don't pay taxes. The truth of the matter is they pay all the taxes, but they don't pay them directly. They don't pay directly. What happens is the government comes along and they tax General Motors. General Motors doesn't pay tax. General Motors passes the tax increase in the price of their automobiles onto the buyers of the automobiles. And they just did the same thing here with the income tax cuts. They gave you the income tax cuts with all this ballyhoo, which moved you up into a higher tax bracket called the alternative minimum tax. So get used to it. It's a part of the Orwellian program. Double speak. Double speak. Now, for you poor people out there, the way we do it is this. When we tax these people, the doctors, and the lawyers, and the dentists, these are the people that make $100,000 to $175,000 a year. Honest to God, do you poor people out there working, you know, for minimum wage, and working for $10 an hour, or you blue collar guys, you know, working for $16 or $20, which is, or 16, I think, is the national median wage now, $16. Honest to God, do you think that that tax is going to benefit you by taxing dentists, doctors, and lawyers? Well, okay, kids, you know, let's think about it, because I'm just like you. I don't like higher prices, but what happens is you raise this alternative minimum tax, and you give it to your dentist. Now your dentist is making $100,000 to $150,000 a year, and he's paying the regular taxes. And Bush comes along and says, okay, now you're making $100,000 a year, Don. So here's what we're going to do. You're paying $25,000 a year in taxes, and you get to spend $75,000. So we're going to give you a tax cut of $10,000 a year. You're only going to have to pay $15,000. And the dentist says, yay, yay, vote for Bush. Vote for Bush twice, in fact. Okay. Now, the alternative minimum tax kicks in, and it's 26%. Got that? So now this guy, he's making $100,000. Bush gave him a $10,000 decrease. He's got to pay $15,000, but now he's kicked into the AMT, so he's got to pay $26,000 on the $100,000 plus the $15,000, so now he's got to pay $40,000. Got this? He was paying $25,000, now he's paying $40,000. One day, old Bert, you know, the dentist, he wakes up and he says, oh my God, I got to raise my prices. I was at the dentist the other day, and the guy charged me $85 to fill a tooth. I can remember when I was a kid, the price was $5. You went in to get your tooth filled or a tooth pulled. $5. Then the other day, my daughter, she's got this wisdom tooth, see? And this wisdom tooth needs to be pulled. Well, I had wisdom teeth. You had wisdom teeth. I turned 21 and I had one of these wisdom teeth. And I was in Eureka, California. I went into the dentist. I paid him $5 and he pulled the wisdom tooth. Of course, that's 50 years ago. $5. You know what it cost me? Listen to this. We took her into the dentist and he says, oh my God, that's a wisdom tooth. That requires oral surgery. I said, hey, dentist, didn't you go to dental school? He says, oh yeah. He said, I went to dental school, but I don't do that kind of work anymore because, you see, we got malpractice. And you know, if I was doing impacted wisdom teeth, you know, I'd have to charge more money, and I'd have to have malpractice insurance, and I can't afford that. So you got to take her to an oral surgeon. And the oral surgeon sent me a bill the other day for $600. $600 to pull a crummy wisdom tooth. So boys and girls, if you thought that George Bush was doing you some big favor by giving you a tax cut, you got your head at the wrong end of your anatomy. So let's wake up and smell the coffee. So there's that little story on the AMT. So I was going to say, gee, what if, what if we had a genuine tax decrease? Tax relief. If we had real tax relief, we could start really getting to the root of our problems. You know, George Washington back in 1790 wrote a letter. I forgot who wrote this letter to now, but the substance of the letter had to do with the state of the economy in 1790. He said, from 1787, when we adopted the Constitution, until today, I cannot believe how well the economy has revived and that trade, commerce, business, and industry is thriving in just 3 years. All right? You know, if you were to abolish OSHA, the EPA, if you abolish these government regulatory agencies, you wouldn't need as much tax to support all this bureaucracy. And your economy would grow like China's economy. See, they don't have the EPA, and they don't have workman's compensation and Social Security and all these taxes, and their economy grows at 9% a year. Argentina just found that out. They went broke here a couple, 3 years ago, and they started sorting things out, and now their economy is growing around 7, 8, 9% a year. America's economy is growing at they say, 3 or 4% a year, and our Federal Reserve is pumping money into the economy at the rate of 10% a year. So the truth of the matter is we're in a recession at the rate of 7% a year. That's the truth of the matter. And we're now seeing inflation of 10% plus a year. They tell us it's 4. And we believe them because, you know, if you can't believe your government, who can you believe? But I'm just saying, you know, what if the government told us the truth? You know, the truth is inflation's running at 10% and unemployment is running at about 12%. It's not the 4.8% that they're advertising. And that's because, you see, when you draw unemployment insurance, they count you as unemployed. And the minute your unemployment insurance runs out, they drop you from the unemployment insurance rolls. So they don't count you as unemployed. I just thought I'd share that with you. Here in our county, I'll show you what the unemployment rate is. 65% of the people in this county are on Social Security. 27% of the people in this county are not employed. Well, let's see, if we had 65% and then we put 27%, that's 92. Boys and girls in Ozark County, Missouri, 92% of the people are not productively employed. So there's only 8% of us here in the county that do anything. See, I'm one of those that's unemployed. I'm not on Social Security and I'm not working anywhere. Just thought I'd share that with you. Now, don't feel sorry for us. Everybody here in the county is eating. There hasn't, to my knowledge, there hasn't been any starvation going on in Ozark County. But you know, the way the government keeps track, you'd think that we ought to be eligible for food stamps and welfare, and I guess many people in the county are, maybe even most of them. I just want to tell you that the problem comes from, what if the government actually told the truth? And you and I then could make decisions about who we wanted to vote for, about whether or not we wanted to buy stocks and bonds, and whether or not we wanted to change employers. You know, we could make our decisions based upon real, honest-to-God facts that had some real weight and meaning, rather than this fairy tale number that we're getting out of government. So I'd share that with you. So the alternative minimum tax over here is a real ruse when it comes to, are you really getting the tax cut? Because the professionals simply raise their prices, and so now you can pay $600 to have your tooth taken out, as opposed to $5. I'll tell you another little thing. You know hamburgers, you know, you went into a restaurant and you wanted to buy a hamburger in 1930, it cost a nickel. In fact, in 1930, when you went into a bar, it cost you a nickel for a beer and the food was free. The bars were making money. They weren't complaining. Today, you go into McDonald's to buy a hamburger and it costs you $1.50 or $2, something like that. I've been in there since 1972. I used to go into McDonald's and buy coffee because they had hot coffee. I can't even buy coffee from them anymore. The government got involved. They can't even serve hot coffee. Not that their food was ever worth eating to start with, but their coffee was. At least I thought it was. You go into McDonald's and pay $1.50. What you're really paying for over here, boys and girls, it's $1.45 worth of tax on a 5-cent hamburger. The hamburger hasn't gone up. The taxes have. In order for you to buy the nickel hamburger and pay $1.45 tax, you've got to have more money. So you're working for $16 an hour. So you're getting paid your $16 and you're happy as a clam at high tide. Well, good for you. But if you take a look, you know, you take a look at where we are today, you find out that you're working more today. You have to put in more hours of labor today. And then when you take your after-tax income and you run out here and you buy it for goods, you're actually getting less actual goods today than you were in 1973. Now, up to 73, you were making honest-to-God wage increase and purchasing power increases. You were working less and buying more until 73, but from 73 on, it stalled. And today, it's actually going down, and that's because of inflation. There's a real neat guy out here that you might want to subscribe to. It's called the Magombo Guru. His hot button in life is inflation. And you just go to kitco.com on Wednesdays. Kitco, KITCO.COM, and you're looking for Magombo. Just do that. It's free. Download it. I think that you'll be surprised. Just pay attention to that every week and pay attention to inflation. And all of a sudden, what if the government actually told us the truth about the numbers that come out of the Department of Labor, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and about taxes? We're being lied to such a degree that I think that the average Russian in 1955 was actually probably, in all likelihood, getting straighter facts out of Izvestia back in the 50s than Americans are getting out of the AP or the UP or the Washington Post or the New York Times or ABC and NBC today in 2006. Now, I don't know that quantitatively, so I'm just suggesting that we knew that Izvestia was lying to the Russians in 55. But most Americans believe the news media is telling them the truth in 2006, and I say that's a step in the wrong direction. Ever heard of Orrin Hatch? Orrin Hatch, well, he's a high muckety-muck in the United States Senate. Well, Orrin Hatch is proposing extending the six-month conveyance claw back vote to 3 years. Here's what that's all about. What he's talking about is that assets from American citizens now expatriating, that's American citizens leaving America and becoming citizens of some other country. Did you know that Americans do that? Would you believe such a thing? Yeah, Americans, 9,000 Americans have deserted the army in Iraq. Did you know that? Yeah, 9,000 American soldiers, let's see what the percentage is. I don't know how many have served over there, but they say there's 130,000 over there. So if you took 9 divided that by 130, that's 6%, almost 7% of American troops have deserted past tense. I don't know how many are in the process. Well, American citizens are leaving America, especially the middle class, because of the alternative minimum tax. That's just one thing. There's other reasons, but anyway, that's the assets. What he's talking about is that assets from American citizens now expatriating, that is leaving our country, that are in a foreign jurisdiction could still be confiscated by the U.S. government for up to 6 months after the citizen has formally expatriated himself or herself. This is not just about leaving the country after the citizen actually gives up their citizenship. So what our government wants to do, a record number of American citizens are fleeing the United States, especially the upper middle class retirees, and they're taking their assets with them. That's probably a loss of $3 million per couple. And the neocons in power, that's the new conservatives, are so incensed and so vindictive that all of the countries that they have tax treaties with, you know, like if they move to Germany, there's a tax treaty with the Germans. So they're being forced to seek out Americans and to tax them on their income. That system won't work well because of the inefficiency of these other countries' tax systems, but the mere fact that these elitists would do this is unconscionable. So they want to tax you to death here in America, and then when you get a belly full of it and you say to hell with this and you want to leave, they're getting kind of vindictive now and they want to take away from you that which you have. And that's the communist way. I mean, that's the American way. It's the communist way. It's the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property, and the fourth plank, which calls for the abolition of all right to inheritance. Yeah, we don't want that. Not in this country. And we learned it from you Ruskies over there. And the Ruskies now have turned to turned to free enterprise, along with the Chinese. Their economies, every week, the Russians are piling up $2 billion a week and have been for the last 20 or 30 weeks that I've been watching in dollars. I mean, they're exporting more to America than we are exporting to them, and they're making money at the rate of $2 billion a week, just like the Chinese. Not as much, not as fast, but they're doing the same thing. Hey, I don't think this bodes well for us, boys and girls. I don't think it bodes well at all. So I just like to ask the question, what if? What if we were to take evasive action before this happens to us? What if we took a look at this and said, hey, I want to avoid the problems that these Americans who are expatriating are having? What if we looked ahead instead of looking back at what happened to us? We looked ahead at what is being done to us and then take the appropriate evasive action and avoid that. Don't let that happen to you. What if? All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. We're out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.